got here. It looks like muddy water.
It does look like muddy water. It really does. Say just a couple things. Let me just check the level. Say, I don't know. Okay. Say,
who the hell are you anyway? To say. You always have to ask a question.
Okay, let me just. Well, the whole idea behind this is to just find out where you learned what you learned, okay. And both with making instruments and with playing music, and to kind of go back as far as we can and to try to trace it back a little bit, and then also to talk just a little bit about how you took what you learned and how you go about teaching that, because how you teach it and how you learned it are probably a little bit different,
probably a lot different.
So I guess the first thing is, just where you lived and how many people were in your family and what it was like where you first grew up.
Well, I was raised in a community called Rugby, Virginia, which is close by the North Carolina line and down the southwestern part of Virginia. It's not too far away from Tennessee. And just a rural, my folks were farmers. And we had we grew tobacco and raised cattle and milk cows by hand and all that stuff. That's things I can remember when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you raise all your own food to eat also?
Yeah, most of it. You had to go to the store sometimes to buy sugar and flour and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But most of the vegetables and all that stuff. My mom canned a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was a good hunter. Always kept rabbits and squirrels and deer and stuff like that,
Did you eat that stuff at home then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was some of my favorite things. Grouse, go out get grouse or some wild turkey. That was a big feast, mm-hmm. come in that. And
was there a big family? Did you have
no
brothers and sisters?
I had one brother and one sister, and they were older than I am. My brother's 9 years older and my sister's 11. And uh-huh. I just almost, they were away from home. Especially my sister, I just barely remember when she was at home.
Mm-hmm.
I think she got married when she was about 16 or so. And my brother, I was mostly raised by my brother. Mom and dad was always out in the, uh-huh. working on the farm. And my brother Max was always around the house, while he was a teenager and stuff, had to take care of the kid,
uh-huh.
keep me out of trouble the best he could.
So was he in school most of that time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He went to the high school we went to was just over and set right smack dab on the North Carolina and Virginia line. And it burned down, I think, the year after I graduated from high school. And I can remember about the.
What was school? Was it just a high school, or was it people from all over the county who came there, or?
Well, that school, there were people from North Carolina and Virginia, just like the,
uh-huh.
I believe the elementary part was governed by the state of Virginia and the high school in North Carolina. I believe
so
the way it was. It was a weird situation,
That is unusual for, usually, at least on the state line and usually on the county line, they'll split it.
Yeah, we always had pretty good funding, because it got money from both states,
mm-hmm.
that one school did.
Mm-hmm. Was there a lot, in your family as you were growing up, was there a lot of emphasis on learning, on education, or not too much?
Probably not too much. On our family, we always had to go to school, And I know a lot of the people in the community didn't, too much. I don't know, the laws probably were not as strict back then. But I don't know, I always thought that was something I had to do. I'd go to school and never miss days, go when I was sick and everything else, because I thought that was a big deal of some kind, to go and not miss. But I know a lot of the kids, where I went to elementary school was a little two-room school, and had the, these old, I don't know if you've ever seen this old desk, where you sit here, a nice old wooden, I remember
yeah.
being made out of bird's eye maple. I used to look at that. I remember being excited about wood even back then. And
did anybody work with wood in your family? Did your father work with wood or somebody around?
My father was just he was a farmer and could do all the building that he needed to do around the farm. Was real handy at you know, everything like that, but he wasn't, you know.
Did he make furniture or do anything fine?
No, he wasn't a real fine craftsman as far as doing things like that, but he was a blacksmith.
Oh, okay.
And his dad, my grandpa was a blacksmith, and his dad before that. And they did all sorts of blacksmith work, you know, like the mainly not decorative stuff, but useful things. You know, they made mm-hmm. horseshoes and mm-hmm. wagon parts and mm-hmm. all the tools that the farmers needed, and they could somehow or other they took the blacksmith shop and welded new blades and things on different tools, you know. I remember I've heard Dad talk about how they did that, and that's a pretty, you know, a complicated blacksmithing
yeah.
operation.
Well, did you hang around and watch him do a lot of that kind of stuff?
Well, the blacksmithing part was pretty much over with, you know, as far as I can remember. And I can just remember my dad doing a little of it. You know, he didn't even have the shop, you know. Then he had gone into pretty much farming full time. But mm-hmm. the time, you know, that I can, when I'm old enough to remember anything in you.
Yeah, yeah.
And
did your mother work with her hands much? Did she make
yes,
things?
Yes, she's real good. She's a good quilter. Makes real fancy quilts. And she was always seemed to be real good at everything, except making music. She never didn't.
She didn't at
didn't,
all.
Didn't her. Play music in any way.
Or dance, anything?
No, not that I've ever seen.
Hmm. Did she like it?
Yeah, oh yes, she loved it. And she had to, as much of it as I always had drag in, you know, everybody in the world would come there, especially after I got to repairing instruments. I'd have musicians and people there at the house all the time. And
well, what got you started playing? Well, what was it first? Did you first make things, or did you first play things?
Well, I first, as far as instruments, now, as far as I can remember, well, my other grandpa was I don't think I mentioned that, he was a coffin maker.
That's your mother's father.
Yeah, okay. And furniture maker, and I always, like any kid, likes to be like her grandpa, you know.
Yeah.
He was always whittling and making things, and so I did too when I was a kid. I liked to, when I could slip out with a knife or something, I'd always make me a little toy pistol or something, you know, mm-hmm. out of wood or anything to play with. And so I was making things first.
Uh-huh.
And my dad was a fiddle player and would, like lots of people did when they'd raise their family, they would quit making music. And yeah. I know down around home, a lot of musicians did that. And then when they get older, it's sometimes people will come around, somebody interested in the music or something will roust them back out and get them playing again.
So what got him playing again?
Well, I can remember not even knowing that he played the fiddle.
Was there a fiddle in the house?
Yeah, there's always an old fiddle in the drawer, but we're not allowed to touch that thing. You know?
Was that pretty strict?
Yeah.
You just couldn't touch
it? Yeah, we just didn't mess with that fiddle, you know.
Did it make you want to touch it when he wasn't looking or when he was gone?
Well, no, not too much. I just thought, now that fiddle, that's a big deal or some kind. I'm not going to mess with it. That's always pretty good to do what my mom and dad told me to do. And after I got up, my brother bought a guitar first. Bought it from Estelval. I remember it, just an old cheap one. It was a pretty good guitar, but it had a great big old neck and the strings high on it. I remember that. And that was about when I was five. And he learned two or three chords on it, and that's about all he ever learned on it. And he showed me those two or three chords, and I'd sit around and bang on that guitar all the time. And he'd, he just kind of left the guitar to me and never let me play it all I wanted to. And I got so I could play, you know, like backup to a fiddle.
Did that happen? Was there another fiddler that you tried to back up, or did you try right off with your daddy?
Well, the first I can remember was, after I got up at least messing with that guitar a little, Dad would get that fiddle out once, mm-hmm. just once in a great while.
Do you remember the first time he did that? You must have been surprised.
I can't exactly remember. I know they used to have I've heard my mom and dad talk about they used to have square dances, shindigs they call them.
Shindigs.
Yeah, they would go to somebody's house on Saturday night. And I've heard them talk about walking for a long ways. And my grandpa, back before that, he and his brother both played music. They played fiddle and banjo. And they were pretty good, and they were the the ones to get to play at the square dances. Mm-hmm. And I've heard them talk about walking. You know, they'd tell me where they went, you know, from their house over to on the next ridge and holler, and as many as the long ways, it'd take you 45 minutes to drive it. Now, I guess it'd have to.
And they'd walk it.
They would walk it and get there in time to go play music and play probably most of the night, I guess, and then maybe walk back by daylight the next morning. I don't know.
When you were young, was that something that you were, that you'd hear a lot about, or something they were embarrassed about, or something that had just passed on? Or
I don't think so. I don't know whether they were embarrassed about it or not, but they was always talking about it. What a big good time they had, you know. I've heard them talk about going back and rolling back a rug, you know, at somebody's house, and then putting down some flour or meal or whatever it was they do on the floor, and just have a great big square dance, you know. And fiddlers, and usually they never talk about that. Never hear them say anything about a guitar player. They always had a fiddle and banjo. Mm-hmm. I recognize, you know, it's really old time music, you know, way back. And getting back to about Dad, he would. Some of the folks that he used to play with, he had a band back in the, I guess, 30s, and along that time, sometime. And a few of those guys were still around the community there, and they'd get together. That's the first I can remember hearing him play.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get together with them, and they'd come to the house or something, and just pick a little bit. And I can remember I wanted to play so bad I couldn't stand it, but I was afraid to, you know, just afraid to.
Well, when had you ever heard a guitar backing people up if all they played is fiddle and banjos?
Well, now, at that time, you know, that was after I was up, you know, 4 or 5 years old. I can remember this fella in the community that played guitar with him back when they,
uh-huh.
And I was talking about my grandpa and his brother way back, you know, they didn't have a guitar player.
But your daddy and his friends or whatever, they already
had a guitar player. That was E.C. Ball. I don't know if you've ever heard of him or not, mm-hmm. but he was about my dad's age or something, and they played together a lot, and they'd had this band called the Rugby Gully Jumpers, and I reckon they traveled around all over the community, you know, too. They didn't travel far and wide, but I guess, like everybody else, had to walk most where they went,
mm-hmm.
and they'd play. They had fiddlers' conventions. They used to have a great big one on the White Top Mountain back in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Albert
Hass, was he there or something?
Albert was, yeah, he was at that thing. That thing got real big when back in 1933, I think, Eleanor Roosevelt came to it. And that was a big deal. I mean, everybody, I can still talk to the old people in the community down there.
Uh-huh.
And you won't hardly talk to any of them that wasn't there. They said,
great.
I forget how many thousands and thousands of people that go on top of that mountain when they had that festival.
Mm-hmm. Well, would that have been a festival like festivals are now, or like a fiddler's convention is now?
Well,
a lot of people gathering around in groups of people just playing music.
Yeah, it sounds the same to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, within this year, I saw an article in the Roanoke Times that had a picture had been taken up there of these four musicians, like a band, three older fellas and a small kid playing the mandolin. And a picture of Eleanor Roosevelt back then. That was the time.
What about competitions? Would they have fiddle contests then?
Yeah, I've heard them talk about having that up there. And I remember one tale that E.C. Ball told me one time. At when that was going on, they had this contest. And said there was some fella up there that had a Martin guitar, a big old D one. I figured it must have been in the early 30s, you know, one of the first ones. He's talking about having a short neck and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they used they had a sound system, and said they would, in order to keep it fair, they would adjust the sound system and not touch it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they had extra microphones for the fiddlers, and, you know, like three mics or something. And said they had that, they set up that microphone with that fellow that was supposed to be a hot band, you know, that had, and they got them to adjust the sound system. Said they used his guitar, big old loud guitar, and said all the rest of them guitars wasn't nothing, you know, just real sorry. And said that just put them all out of business. So they adjusted it up, cut it down real low because that guitar was so loud. And then when the rest of them played, you
couldn't ever hear it.
You know,
that's funny.
I remember tales like that told me about. And when I got, that, I don't know, I guess 5 or 6 years old or something, My dad found out that I could play rhythm guitar good enough to back up fiddle play. And he really got into playing a lot more then. And
so when he played, would it just be, say, the two of you, or would people come over and have a big party or something?
Either way. He would even almost quit, you know, working out in the field or anything, even when something important needed to be done. You get to talking to him about fiddling a little bit or something. He said, well, let's go play one or two. We can play one or two. Then we've got to get back out here and end up playing all evening.
Did he know a whole lot of tunes?
Yeah, he knew most all the old standard tunes, you know, that you hear now. You know, not any.
Do you know any of the kind of, any strange old crooked tunes or anything like that? Mostly the standard tunes.
Not too much, just the standard ones that you always hear. Ragtime Annie, Arkansas Traveler. Most all of those, but nothing real unusual I can think of.
What about, what was his fiddle style like? What was his?
Let's see, I can't think right off hand, think of anybody. It was just pretty much normal. It wasn't anything real unusual.
Did he play a lot of, like, double notes together? And was it sweet,
or was it
real rhythm, or was it?
Real rhythm. He was played real good timing. He was real easy to play with. I have played with fiddle players that were, you know, it was more complicated to keep good timing with them and everything. But he was real good. Taz always easy. I've heard that the fella that the ball fella that used to play with him all the time said that about him. He's always played real good timing, easy to play with.
Did he dance at all?
No, not that I know. I think I've heard my mother's still alive. I'll have to ask her about some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think he did, but they most likely ended up having to play every time they'd go to a square dance or something.
So he wouldn't get a chance to dance too much?
Probably not.
Well, now what about making all that stuff?
Well, making all those instruments, I guess, got started by just by necessity, you know, like that fellow, the ball fellow there, and had that Martin guitar. I would go up and look at that thing and just couldn't believe how good it sounded, you know, and there was no way in the world that we could afford that much for a guitar, you know. That was something that it was a luxury, not a necessity, you know. And so I just thought, now I'm going to have to make one. I know that I can make things, you know. And so that's what I started doing. I remember the first time I tried to make one. I made a little one. My mother showed it to me not long ago. I'd forgotten about it. It was made out of a cardboard box. And it had a pretty nice neck whittled out to it, a wooden neck. I'd put
on the cardboard box.
On a cardboard box.
Was the cardboard shaped like an hourglass like that, or was it?
No,
was it
it was completely square, but it had a sound hole and a bridge on it, and it had the
little strings.
I had some old, you know, like fiddle pegs put in that peg head from up through from the backside, and had a little bridge on it with pins. It worked.
That's great.
And you can imagine this had like probably threads, strings like thing, like a not real guitar string, because it never would hold it. You know, probably even had some maybe fish line or something.
So how old would you have been when you put that together?
I would say probably somewhere between 6 and 9. Or
pretty
something.
Young.
And and then the next time I tried to make one, that's after I'd gotten that old guitar my brother had, and I tried to copy it. You know, I drew patterns and things and made it out of, I remember I found a piece of masonite board, and I didn't know how in the world I was going to get the sides bent. I knew they had to be bent, but I had no idea how to do it. And my mom had there's an old dresser drawer in there that I had noticed before. It was made out of veneer, you know, walnut veneer, you know, it's thin wood that's glued on.
Right.
And so I figured, now if I can get that dresser drawer bottom out of there without mom having a fit or knowing about it, you know. So I slipped that thing out one day, and I think I got into some other old piece of plywood or something put in there, and so she wouldn't notice it, and laid it out in a branch. Went down behind the house one evening right late, and I figured, now that might soak that veneer loose so I can get that off there and I can bend that for the sides. And this was up to, I was probably 13 or 14 years old or something then. And so I I'd let that thing soak all night out there in the branch, you know, before the water ran over it. And went there the next morning, got up early the next morning, there and see, and went there and it hadn't budged. And I didn't know, I was real disappointed, you know, and I didn't know what to do. I went back out there about lunchtime that day, and that piece of walnut veneer had floated on down the branch. Down
there.
You talk about tickled death, and I gathered that up, and I'd made me a little shop out there. It used to be the meat house, you know, where we keep where you kill hogs and everything, keep the meat, and I cleaned that out, and I made me a little shop in there, and I bent those sides, and then I glued up little wood posts along that guitar, and cut that veneer out, and it just bent like a dream around it. That's what I hadn't had it made then. I didn't have any glue. The only glue I could find was some old, this old black stuff was in a tube that Dad had been putting weather stripping around his truck door. But that stuff would stick right then, you know. And I didn't even have to wait for it to dry or anything. Just put that around there. And I worked my whole, you know, summer vacation off from school. I worked on that every time I had, you know, between putting up the hay and stuff. And I got that guitar all glued together and had it, the body made, neck on it. And everything, went out there one morning. I don't know whether it got damp or warm or something that night. Went out and looked, and that thing had blossomed out like a morning glory. It just those sides had straightened out, and that old rubber glue was stretched on. I'm telling you, you talk about disappointed. There was my whole summer's work and all the dreams of my guitar being made. And I can't imagine much of a worse disappointment, you know, that I've ever had that I can remember. And I didn't know what to do then. And I'd heard my dad talk about Albert Hash.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, pretty well-known fiddle maker and fiddler that lived in the same community, but, you know, 20 miles away or so. You know, it's hard for me to travel that far. So I talked my dad into taking me over to Albert's or something. He knew him. Went over there and told Albert all my problems and everything. And Albert was one of the nicest people I've ever met. You know, he's just a super nice person.
Is he still around? He's
been dead for, I'd say, 4 or 5 years now. 3 to 5 or something. And Albert said, "Now I'll tell you what I've got." Said, "You want to make you a guitar?" And somebody had gave him one of those doors, something like that. Uh-huh. Like a bathroom door that's mahogany, like the ones on the inside of a house.
Uh-huh.
Somebody had tried to cut that thing off, you know, too long. They didn't know they were hollering on the inside and ruined it, you know. And they'd given it to Albert. And he said, I'm going to give you this mahogany wood right here. It was plywood, what it was, but still. And he told me how to bend it.
What did he say?
And he said, you have to bend it over a hot pipe.
Uh-huh.
And wet it and bend it over a hot pipe. So you talk about excited. Now I went home in a hurry. And I started working on that right then. And the only way I could think of to get a hot pipe is we had a heated the house with an old coal stove. And I took a piece of that 1.5-inch water pipe that had an elbow on the end with about a 6-inch crook down on it. And I guess the pipe was a couple of feet long. And I'd stick that thing right down in the bottom of that stove, leave it in there just like the poker, you know, for a while. And it'd be red all the way up just in a little bit. And I'd jerk that thing out there and work right in the back room at the house. I'd run in there and screw that thing up in a vise right tight, and I'd just bend like crazy for about, a minute and a half or something until it cooled off. And that was an awful job, you know, to get that done. But I got those sides bent like that pretty good and got that guitar put together.
And, what did you use for glue?
Albert told me about glue that time, too. I told him all my problems I'd had to that oven. He said, "Now you go." He did. I don't know whether he had any. And I said, "You go down there and buy you some weld wood glue." You know? And so I did that. And I remember I put plenty of it on there too. and I finally got that guitar finished. I mean, I worked on it probably for, I don't know, maybe six months. And all I had to go by was what I could go feeling around the inside of EC's old Martin guitar, and I got the pattern to the outside of it. And I got pretty close, but it's really a crude thing. But that guitar still isn't exactly the same shape that it was. My mother still has it. It's the first one.
How does it sound?
Well, it sounds pretty good. It's nothing like the ones now. But, you know, I put a great big heavy brace, and I was afraid it'd come apart, you know. I've done been scared by that once.
That's great.
And then after I got that guitar, I mean, like, well, the other thing, you know, like the bridge pins that hold the strings in, I'd go out and get old cow bones I'd find out in the field and a file and file those things out round and made all six of them and inlaid them and put them in the, make, I mean, do enough work on six bridge pins to make 15 guitars now, you know.
I'll bet. What did you use for pegs? And, that first one.
I think Estelle ordered me a set from Martin, and he could. I didn't know you could order anything from Martin. That's back in that's in early '60s, and I know I was about. I think I was about 17 years old when I got that guitar done, and it's still in good shape. And that's the first one I ever got made. It was a pretty playable instrument, like the little inlay lines that go down the back. You know, they're made out of marquetry that's made in Germany, all these little tiny blocks of wood, and I thought, well, there's somebody up there that sets up there and makes those things, you know, something. So I got me up a bunch of walnut and maple, which would be different colors, and whittled out all those little blocks.
And oh my gosh, can you imagine?
And made all that.
Wow.
And I had plenty of patience, you know. I didn't mind sitting there and working on the one inlay strip for 2 days, you know. But I was really excited when I got that done. First thing I had to do when that guitar was done is take it and show it to Albert. And Albert was the kind of person, it didn't matter what you, or I don't reckon it would, what you would have taken up there to him, he would really have bragged on it. And I took that up there and all, he just, all the encouragement in the world said, "Well, son, you just outdone yourself this time." And it was really, it's really a mess, you know, with today's standards, you know. But hearing Albert say that, you know,
that was enough right there.
That's enough to keep you going. And he
said, now what happened between that time and now? Because you're making these beautiful instruments now. How did you learn kind of the real way to do it?
Well, I think just by practicing, you know. That I know that when I showed Albert that guitar, I said, "Now, I'll tell you what I'm going to do." He said, "You've done a real good job here." He said, "I'm going to order you some rosewood to make you a guitar." And he did, and then ordered me a set of rosewood. And that guitar was much nicer, you know. I did better work on it and learned a few things.
Did you still bend it around the pipe the same way?
Yeah, probably did the same way for several of them. And then it wasn't too long until my brother got a job working in the same factory that Albert did. It was the same thing, a machinist, you know. And then it got, so, you know, I got to my brother to making me some tools and things, other than my pocket knife and rasp and stuff. That's all I had to work with about. And I know he made me a sander and some, you know, real neat. Some of them I still have. And he still makes nice tools for me today. And Albert was always handy with suggestions on ways of doing things. Albert didn't make guitars, but
he... How did he learn how to make fiddles? Do you know?
Well, I've just heard lots. I've heard him tell lots of tales about. I mean, that's a great big long story about Albert. I can tell you one thing that he told me about when he got his first fiddle bow. Albert was a genius when it came to figuring out ways to do things. But now I don't know what about his ideas about how he got that fiddle bow now. I mean, he thought all the fiddle bows he'd ever seen had white hair in it. And he thought the only way that you could get that would be from a white horse's tail. And didn't know where one, he hadn't think the mailman rode one. And he knew where mailman stopped and eat lunch every day. And tied his horse up beside the fence. And I almost can't believe Albert did this, but he said he slipped up and said he undone the horse's bridle, you know, where he had it tied to that post. And said he got on the other side of the fence and said he slipped up there and said he knotted both of his fingers just as much as he could get a hold of through that horse's tail and pulled it through the fence and just got a hold of it like that and then let out a big scream and scared that horse. So that horse made a big jump like that and said it just about strained him through that fence. He said when he kind of woke up a little bit, said he looked and he had two great big handfuls of hair. And said he went back home and made him a bow then. And then said his fiddle wouldn't work. Said he made that bow, said he made a real nice bow with plenty of hair in it and everything. Said he started fiddling on it, said not one sound would it make. Nothing. And he said he didn't know what, and said he's you know, probably felt like I did, you know, he's disgusted and nothing. And he'd already done all that work to make that first fiddle, and nothing would happen. He'd fiddle as hard as he could, but it would make no sound at all. And what was wrong? He didn't have any rosin on that hair. That hair was just slick across the string. And he went up, and there was somebody. And said he'd never come out behind her until he could play a tune on it. And I've heard Albert tell that tale lots of times.
Well, now tell me one more thing. How did you start flat picking your guitar instead of just doing backup? What made you start doing that? What made you think about doing that?
Probably about, we had a few old, we had those old wind-up Victrolas and a few Carter family tunes, and I'd heard Mayvale, you know, pick out, you know, she picked leads out on the guitar, and Jimmy Rogers hit a few licks on his too. We had a few of them records. And had Riley Puckett playing on there too. He's somebody else that picked a lot of stuff on the guitar. And then this fella, the neighbor, had DeMartin, you know, EC, now he picked out tunes. And I started out, you know, probably trying to flat pick, like with a flat pick, like everybody else. And I always remember I had a lot of trouble holding on to it. And it'd fly off down the sound hole and all that stuff. And I thought, now this is a lot of trouble, you know. And I could finger pick a little. And I'd go up to see Astle. He finger picked more of Travis style. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, he always told me those flat picks were evil. Said if you want to really play a guitar, you better get you some finger picks, you know. And so, I mean, I believed as a kid, you know. I thought that was gospel, you know. And so that's why I started playing. But the style I play sounds like flat picking, because that's mm-hmm. the only way I can play. You know, I can't do a very good finger picking style. Mm-hmm. And I don't like this way I've been playing ever since.
When you first started playing tunes, were you playing the tunes that your father had
played? Yeah. That's mainly how I'd get started. You know, he'd be playing, he'd be playing fiddle tune, ragtime, Annie, or whatever. And next thing I know, I'd get tired of playing rhythm then. I'd start maybe picking out a lead. They didn't like it. Fiddle players, most of them still don't like it. They want you to sit back there and play rhythm for them, make them sound good, you know.
Well, how come you never went and learned how to play fiddle?
I don't know. Because
if you wanted to play the melody, you might have just picked up the
fiddle. Yeah, I don't know how come I never did think about it.
Especially with Albert Hash around
there. Yeah, I played with Albert for 8 years in a row one time. We even had it in one of them Saturday morning radio shows, you know.
That's great. And
I don't know. But then, you know, Albert was always, you know, one of my favorite fiddle players, you know. Had him, you know, didn't need anybody else to learn to play the fiddle. And at home, I'd play with my dad some. He's always the fiddle player around there, you know. Right. I don't know how come. What little bit of fiddling I do is awful.
Well, let me let you go since you have to go to the thing that you're doing. And what I wanted to ask you about now is, how long have you been teaching here, and how did you get started teaching here?
Okay, let me think. Yeah, that did happen. I really don't know. I'd say Michael probably came down to my shop.
How did Michael know you?
I really don't know. We'll have to ask him, I guess. Well, you know, somebody like Michael, you know, travels around a lot to lots of music, and I'm sure to Galax and places like that. And he came to my shop one time. I remember, I just barely remember him being there, but I remember showing him this Mongoose thing that I've got down in my shop. It's a thing that I made a long time ago. It's an animal cage. And it's a, you know, it's a box about this long,
uh-huh.
And it's got about this wide, and it's got a screen. The top of it is a screen,
uh-huh.
And the back part back in here, there's a hole about so big, looks like a little animal hole. And the back part of the box stands up about this high, and this square or something with a lid on top, like the door.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a fox's tail on the inside of it, and you can curl down and see the hair of that tail up through that little hole. and a screen door spring under the lid, which forces the lid open instead of shut, and a little screen door hook on the back of it. And I've got a string to that hook. It runs down through my counter and stand over my stove in the shop. When people start asking what that is, what I've got in that cage, and I tell them it's a mongoose thing to eat you up if you got a hold of it. All and they want to see it then. And they'll start pecking on that screen or raking on it, trying to get it. I tell them, well, you peck on that screen, you can get it out before you can see it, but be careful, you know. So when they get them all good and excited about that and everything, they pull that string, it unhooks that thing, that lid flies open, and that foxtail's on a string just flops right out the top. Michael saw that thing. I remember him
Michael
seeing
it. Michael would like that.
And yeah, it scares the daylights out of people. They just go backwards, screaming and hollering.
That's
great. And that's the first time I remember seeing Michael. He came. Somebody brought him to the shop. I think I can't remember who. Been right a long time ago. And I guess that's probably how they probably gotten, you know, interested in having me to come up here and do this.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, I just got a letter one day or a call. I think Margot called me. Just called at my house or something one time and asked if I would be interested in doing that. And I told her, well, I didn't know whether I could or not, but I might be interested in trying to. And I'd heard Albert came up here one time.
Oh.
Several years ago. I mean, I hadn't heard him say much about it. Or I can't remember ever, you know, getting into talking to him about it, but I did know that he came up here and had a right good time. But I can never... I can't remember, you know, going into it with Albert and talking about him, because that was, when I started coming up here, Albert was about gone. And
so when did you start coming up here?
4 years. This is my fourth year. And the first year I came up here, I did a class on repairing instruments.
How long?
Just for 1 week. And that went pretty good. I had some real good students, and they seemed to enjoy themselves and learn right much, too. And I just got talking to Margo and told her I believe that we could make guitars, like if we had 3 weeks to do it. And so we talked about it. She said we'd just try it, you know. So we did that year, we did 3 students. And I think the first year it was real hard to get people to, you know, to do it, because they didn't think it could be done. I think they had had other people around here that said they couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be impossible to make a guitar in 3 weeks, and also the humid conditions up here said they didn't think you could make a guitar. But I knew that it's not that different from where I live, and my glue always sticks and works down there and everything. I wasn't worried about that. I was worried about being able to do it in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But that first week we got... all 3 of those guitars finished almost right on the last day. And so the next year, last year we had 5 students. After that first year, I mean, everybody heard about it, and I think it had people jumping on it.
Mm-hmm.
They had 5 students.
And even with 5, you could still finish them in the 3 weeks?
Yeah, we even did better. I have one of these same students that are in there. Well, 3 of them. Came back, but this one fellow, who's a fast worker, got his done like on Tuesday of the last week. And every guitar that we've made have turned out real nice.
Oh, that's great.
And I got to see 3 of them. You know, they brought them back and they're still in real good shape. Nothing's happened to them.
So what made you decide? So this year is the first year that you're doing mandolins in, right?
Yeah. Well, they'd had a lot of people talk to me, maybe to Margot and Michael and them too, I don't know, but everybody said, why don't you make some mandolin? I'd like to do that, you know. And I don't know those people either. The people that came back are the same students I had last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they knew how to get on it quick. And I just, you know, I told Margot last year, when I got through my 3 weeks, I hate to leave, you know, everything. It's so much fun and everything up here. And I thought, well, I'd like to have a couple more. I'd like to stay for the whole thing, maybe do a mandolin course. And she said, that'd be fine, you know. And so that's what we did. But
how did you go about deciding how to teach what you knew?
Well, that's something I really don't know either, you know. It's that I just figure, well, whatever I do, I can just take somebody and show them how. You know, I don't have any lesson plans or all that stuff. I'm definitely not a teacher, you know, as far as that goes. I just figure I'm a craftsman that can just show somebody how to do something.
So how much do you prepare before you come up here? I mean, do you have wood? What shape is the wood in when you get up here?
Well, like, there are certain things that can't be done around here as far as, like a thickness sander. We don't have access to that anyway, and I have one at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I glue the pieces together enough to run them through that sander and get the proper thicknesses, like for guitars. And that's the main thing that I do to it. And, you know, it's just in a flat panel. When they come, they have to bend their own wood and cut out mm-hmm. the shapes and all that stuff. And that's something I tell them how to get that done. You know, when you order wood from companies, it comes in rough pieces. And it's, you know, simple enough operation to join it together and glue it together. And you have to take it to, like, some furniture plant or somebody who's got a shop that has one of those machines to get it run through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, you know, that somebody just learning or making one or two guitars couldn't afford to have a machine like that, because it cost a lot, and then you couldn't to find one
right.
too.
But in other words, you teach them enough about all the processes that you have to do before you get here, and then also when they get here, so they can do it on their
yeah.
own.
What little I do to it before I get here, I explain to them how it's done and how they can get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I show them how to slot fingerboards by hand. But if they don't want to do that, there's always companies that sell them already slotted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, machine work. That you can most always, you know, order pieces that that's already done too.
But they're doing that by hand here?
Yeah.
In the workshop? Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I show
so
them
describe,
how to do it.
Describe sort of the steps in the process of making a guitar.
Well, usually when we come in the first day, we'll bend the sides. You know, they get shaped, you know, a certain shape. And then we bend them like
bowling. How thick is the wood on the side?
It's like 3/32
mm-hmm.
of an inch. And that's less than an eighth, it's slightly more than a 16th.
Right.
And they got to be pretty thin so you can bend them. And then we've got this pot that's like cooking beans, just bowling. And they get soaked real good. And then we take the way I do it, I think I was telling you earlier about sticking the old water pipe down in the coal stove, you know, at home. You know, the first one I did. Now I have a little pipe that I clamp up in a vise and run a torch through it. And I have had electric ones, but the torch works fine, you know. And so that gets that pipe hot, and you just stand there by hand and just shape that wood around the pipe. Like if you want the, you know, the bulged out part of the wood on mm-hmm. the outside, like a big bout of a guitar, the pipe goes on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it like steams the wood all the way through, and you see it get dry on the outside. And keep it good and hot, and just keep forming it, sliding it back and forth around there. It dries that wood, it stays bent, right in that shape. I've had them lay in my shop for years and never straighten out.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll also will break. Like once you get that wood bent, if you try to straighten it back like it was to start with, it'll break before it's straightened. And I don't know it's what happens to the wood or what does that, but it just sort of bends it. And after we get those sides bent, we have forms. That's something that I do, too, is make forms. You know, that's something that takes a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
and we wouldn't have time to do it here. And This time, my students got done earlier, and they made their own form. Sometimes I sell them to them, or sometimes, you know, I get to liking them real good and give them to them. They don't feel right selling them, charging them $25 for a form or something. But this year was even better. They had time, and one of them was a carpenter and had a bunch of scrap plywood, and we glued up a bunch and made almost everybody one,
mm-hmm.
so they could take it home and have it, make another guitar. And
so the form is used to shape the sides around it?
Yeah,
is that
it's okay. A wood frame that's shaped just like the outside of a guitar with this little spreader with a turnbuckle on the inside. And you can turn it spreads it like a shoe thing on the inside. It spreads the sides
mm-hmm.
apart
mm-hmm.
in the waist, and then that makes the sides go out against the form everywhere. And after you get the that side's in the form, you glue the blocks in. And there's lots of real neat little tricks, you know. I remember the first time I tried to cut the neck dovetail joint, or the first several guitars. I just would take a pocket knife and a chisel and hammer and try to hammer that out. It's a horrible job to ever get a dovetail.
Do you use a router to do it now?
Do it on a table saw. Okay. One day you just got to trying to figure there's got to be some better way to do this and easier. And so once I finally got a table saw, you just angle the blade, you know, the degrees, and then you make these little jigs, these little blocks of wood that are slanted the proper angle. You just screw it right on the side of the block and turn the angle of the blade and just make two cuts through there, and it cuts that real neat little V-shaped cut, and then just knock the inside out with a chisel. It might take at the most 10 minutes to do one. and you save those same two little blocks when you get ready to make the neck to fit the body. You use those same two blocks and remember the same angle that you turned your blade to and screw them on the side of the neck blank and do the same operation. And then that makes the dovetail that goes on the neck. Then when you're assembling the body, you have to get those sides and blocks all glued up.
So you get the sides and then the blocks, and then what do?
Well, see, that locks it in the form. When you glue those blocks to the ends of the sides, your sides are there then on. And you do the backs then next. Glue the back on first. You know, you got to make all your bracing. That's making the back is an operation. You know, you have to do all you have to make the back of a guitar. Making the braces and gluing them on.
Sometimes on the back of a guitar there's like an inlay strip down the middle of the back.
On most all. The most of the ones that I do now, like where they have a real fancy little wood inlays, I buy those things. And they come from Germany and don't cost more than $2 or $3. And where I used to sit and making them for 2 or 3 days, cutting up all those tiny little blocks of wood.
For $2 or $3, you might as well buy them.
Oh yeah, you can't afford to.
Not to.
And, but for somebody, if they just want to make one guitar and don't care if it takes them a year to do it, let's see, we got 3 weeks to make them. And you have to, you know, use a few things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like the little strips of herringbone that go around the top. That's the same kind of stuff made out of little blocks, and you have to bend it just like bending inside, which is a job, without tearing it up and causing it to come apart and all that kind of stuff.
So what happens after the back goes on?
Okay, after the back goes on, you can there's this kerfing. It's called kerfing. It goes around the inside, and you notice down in the corner you get all these little slotted pieces of wood. That stuff has to be put in, you know, before the back and top's glued on. But your braces, to make a really a nice, clean job, have to be jointed into that. And the reason you put the back on first is that that joint that goes in there has to be calculated and measured, and you have to chip out of the place, and that stuff's real easy to fall apart. And you're like little corners off of it. And you almost, but as many times you have to keep trying and making sure that back fits, you'll knock off little chips and pieces. And if you put the back on first, that's the part that people can look down through the sound hole and see. And you put the back on first because you can go back when that back is glued on and put glue little inlays or blocks back and make it look real neat around the end of the braces. And that's the reason the back is put on first. One of the main reasons. And after you get the back on, you glue the top on, and then you've got the body assembled, you know, put together, and you can take your spreader thing out of the inside, which comes out through the sound hole. And then you unscrew the forms where they're put together, and then just take them off. And then you come out with a guitar body.
And you're ready for the neck.
You have to route it and do whatever inlays you do to the binding, you know, the edges of it. And then you've got lots of scraping and sanding to get everything smoothed out real good. I like to use scrapers because they're straight and they cut any little humps and bumps and imperfections like that out. Like where just plain sanding follows little ridges, and it'll make it slick and shiny and everything, but it doesn't work as good as a scraper. A scraper makes everything smooth and pretty when you get done. Then it doesn't take as much sanding, and the sanding you do is just to polish and finish. And then you're ready to start making a neck. Then you do the necks, usually come from a 4x4, ordering like a 4x4 by 24 inches.
What are they made of?
Mahogany.
The neck is too?
Yeah.
So the back and the sides and the neck are all mahogany?
Yeah, the ones we make here are. And most of the guitars I make back home in my shop are rosewood.
Mm-hmm.
That's just seem to be what most people want their instruments made out of. And when you order that 4x4, if you cut it just right, be real particular where you lay out your pattern, you can cut two necks out of it and turn them, they just touch, you know, almost. Mm-hmm. One's this way or half, you know, like it.
Like a pair of shoes in a shoebox.
Yeah, exactly, same thing. Yeah. And you can, they don't need to be quite 4 inches wide, so you can slab you off three little 1/4 inch pieces off the side enough to make all that curving that goes on the inside of a couple of guitars.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So if you be real saving with your wood, I mean, I was raised to have to watch out for stuff like that. And so I try not to waste any wood. And I worry about it getting gone. It seems like it gets harder and harder to get really beautiful, nice wood, you know,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
you want to work with all the
mm-hmm.
time. Plus, they're more expensive, too. And
how do you go about making the neck?
Well, the first thing you do is, you know, is block out those blanks. Then you sand the plane where the peg head veneer is glued on, and the fretboard has to be perfectly flat and straight. That has to do with, you know, the playing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you leave that a little bit crooked in any way, it'll you might end up with fret buzzes you'll never be able to get at and don't know where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be real careful to get that straight. Then you
what like, is the fingerboard made out of ebony? Or
yeah, pink? Most of the time it's ebony. And when you square up the big end, you know, like where your dovetail is going to be, and you take those little blocks that you save from the very first process where you cut that little head block out, and you screw them on the side,
mm-hmm.
just with a screw that don't go in too deep, just enough to hold it on good and tight. And it's bigger than it needs to be, and that gets cut away, so your screw hole means
mm-hmm.
nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just, after you get your little template blocks on the side, you angle your blade the same, 15 degrees like you did to start with,
mm-hmm.
and adjust it up out of the table. The right distance is the length of the dovetail. And you just make your cuts, and you measure how wide, and set the rip fence on the table saw over the proper distance to make a dovetail turn out to be the right width.
Mm-hmm.
And then just make those two cuts, just one way, and then turn around and do the other one. Then you,
do you put the fingerboard on the neck before you put the neck on the body?
Yeah, I do. Now, there's different ways of doing it. Classical guitar makers, I think, lots of times glue the neck and body together before they put the fingerboard on.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never done that. I finish with the body and neck separate and to make the finishing process easier.
Mm-hmm.
And makes it an easier job to do all the sanding and stuff. It happens around the heel of the neck.
Mm-hmm. Right, I can imagine that.
And about making that dovetail cut, you leave one of those blocks where it is, like to make the second cut. So you make one little V-shaped cut down the end of that block. So you've got a dovetail that's sitting in there, but it's not cleared out. It's got all this wood around it. And then you just turn the neck over on its side with one block where it's still sitting, screwed fast, and you take the other block off the other side and glue it, or not glue it, but spot screw it on the side of the blank up about 10 inches away from that block, so it makes a place for it to slide like
mm-hmm.
this, you know, so it don't, if it just had one here, the neck would flop down like this and wouldn't be level.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just adjust the rip fence to the length of the dovetail, the right length, and then adjust it up far enough where it cuts all the way through and just make a pass there, and that little piece just drops out. You've got
that's
half
clever.
Your neck.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do the same process on the other side, and then sometimes that neck will just drop down in there and fit just perfect if you've got all your angles figured
mm-hmm.
right.
And other times you got to mess with it a little
lots
bit.
Of time, lots of the most of the time you have to mess with it.
Mm-hmm.
Do it like, which is no big deal if you practice at it. You know, it's just like resetting the neck in an old guitar. Sometimes you have to file a little off here and a little there until you get it where the string action is, when you start paying attention to your string action. If you want to set one nice and low, you have to just angle back a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And do whatever you have to get that right. and get that all done. Then you set up a table saw and cut a little groove for your truss rod. I usually put an adjustable truss rod in my guitars that adjust through the sound hole.
Mm-hmm.
And you just do the proper routing and notching out places for that so you have room to do it.
So the truss rod goes all the way up through the neck?
Yeah.
And then into the body?
Yeah, it goes.
And comes out?
It's blocked in a little block of steel up under the peg head.
Uh-huh.
Before the head plate veneer goes on. And then there's a little, you route out a little notch in the top of the head block. So when that neck goes in, that little rod's about, like a tap that screws on your rod's about an inch long and sticks out through the block so you can get to it inside.
So that's why the veneer is there, is just
to do repairs,
so you can take it off and put it back on easily?
Now the veneer on the peg head,
yeah.
There's no adjustment up there at all. You can't even see it.
Okay, that's just where it goes in.
Yeah, and that's, all guitar necks have a 1/16 inch thick veneer on the peg head where they put their name and their inlays or whatever goes on the peg head.
How deep is the inlay if it's only a 1/16 of an inch?
Well, the inlays sometimes will go all the way through that little piece of wood, which means nothing. See, it's glued down solid to the mahogany under it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they don't go all the way through. They're all discording how thick a material you have.
What is inlay made of?
The most of the inlays that I use is pearl.
Mm-hmm.
Mother of pearl and abalone.
Where do you get that?
Well, you can order it from, there are supply places now that sell abalone and mother of pearl already processed into little flat pieces, ready to be sawed with your jeweler saw or whatever mm-hmm. you use to cut it with. And it's especially abalone is getting pretty scarce now, like everything else. I don't know whether they're an endangered species, but mm-hmm. they get harvested for eating. They eat them out in California. They come from the Pacific Ocean. Somebody was telling me just the other day about had hunted a diver and said an abalone shell looks like almost like a bowl, like a small bowl, about
mm-hmm.
average probably 6 to 8 inches around, and the pretty stuff is right down on the bottom, and it's real hard to get out. It's like almost like cutting a soft stone, and when you the dust off of it, they say, is real dangerous, too. I didn't know that when I was young, and I used to cut up an awful lot of it. I could go up to the junk stores, flea markets, and they'd always have some of those things laying around. You could buy them for nothing and cut them up myself, but where it's so expensive, where it's already cut. And they say it's dangerous about, the dust will do things to you.
Breathing it in, yeah. Yeah, huh.
And so I try to not do that much anymore. I used to do a lot of it. But I don't know whether it's done anything or not. But I've seen results of it. It'll do some bad things to you.
Huh.
It might be, I kind of feel like it might be a little bit of an allergic reaction to it somehow.
Huh.
I know another guitar maker out in Kentucky that he had a real bad experience with that stuff. He rigged up some sort of an electric machine that cut it, and it stirred up a lot of heat and fumes off of it. He said was bad, as bad as the dust. And it set up some kind of he had a mask of a thing. I almost said, come up in here, and it set up something just like Edie's face up. I mean, he looks awful. And I said it cost him about $20,000 in the hospital and everything, and he's a mess. And he said that's where it came from, was from working abalone. So that kind of scared me, so I don't mess with it. I try to mm-hmm. set up, what little bit I saw was with my little hand jeweler saw, which, don't stir up enough dust that I can smell it or almost not even see it. But
So you cut the inlays out of that, and then what's left to do?
Well, after you get the, there's all this shaping, like your neck has to be shaped the way you want it to feel, for playing or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
I usually do that with a belt sander and my pocket knife. That's still my favorite tool to work with, my pocket knife.
After all the building you've done?
Yeah, all the guitars I've made, everything, I still shape the neck, the final shaping, every one I've ever done with a pocket knife.
Wow.
And sometimes I use a rasp a little bit and a belt sander. If you practice one of those things, that's fast. It don't take me but a few minutes to just get one shaped right down close and then to where I can finish it with my pocket knife. And that, then after you get all your shaping and sanding, then you got to go over and make sure the body is sanded exactly right. And that's one of the most important steps of getting a real good job is getting a good job of sanding. That seemed like the lowly job, you know.
Yeah, but it's important in anything you build, out of wood. Is that important so that things fit well or so it sounds good?
Well, both. You know, you talking about like the neck?
When you do the body, you said sanding the body.
Yeah. I think that's got to do with the sound, especially, you know, the inside. Lots of factory-made guitars or cheaper guitars. You notice if you ever look on the inside of one, the braces are right from a rough saw. And
having all those sanded makes a big difference in how it sounds.
Yeah, like pieces of wood will be like wood fibers, you know, like it'll be like fuzzy, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that hurts the sound. You know, sound waves travel around in there all over the place, you know, before they come out, and all that stuff would distort them, you know.
Rough
pieces of wood, and I think for polished and sanded real nice on the inside, besides just showing good workmanship, you know, I think it has something.